Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Welcome to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One. This is Mark Hamilton, joined as I always am by my colleague, my coworker, some might even say my friend, Mr. Mark Daly, here for another round of Formula One news just hours before cars, in theory, should start hitting the track at Interlagos. Now, it's been a busy day. This isn't even the first podcast that we've recorded today. We were invited to join Tim Haraney earlier today on the Racing Pod. So expect to see that in our stream sometime tomorrow as a bit of a bonus. But my friend, how the heck are you?
Not doing too bad. And I was just thinking, we're right in the middle of this very, it's going to be the most weirdest, bizarrest triple header in the history of Formula One. We're going Mexico, we're going Brazil, and then we're going to the Middle East. It's usually they're a little bit more compact and a little bit more centralized than that. But before we get into it, Mark, I just wanted to mention that today is Thursday, November 11th. That means it's Remembrance Day in Canada, Veterans Day in the USA. So on behalf of us both, thank you to all of our veterans, past and present, especially those that have, done the hard work, done the hard thing, and especially those that have made the ultimate sacrifice. And that goes for those that have stood up and fought against oppression and tyranny anywhere. And a special shout out to those of you that are on active duty right now and deployed. We owe you a debt of gratitude that we can never fully repay, but important to remember them all, one and all, this evening. All right, well, let's get into the show. Like you say, there's plenty of news to talk about, plenty of things going on. As I just said, of course, we're in this middle of this, the bizarrest triple header ever. And I mean, you could almost even tack Coda onto that because we only had a week off in between Mexico and the USA. And, I can't help but thinking if I was involved, I mean, I'd love to be. I mean, don't get me wrong if that was my job, but I mean, I can't help but think that sometimes some of the people that are in the F1 circus must wake up in the morning and wonder, what country am I in today?
Oh, I completely agree. And you're right. It's not even so much that it's this bizarre continent hopping triple header. It's we start in COTA, we get a week off, but for everyone in Formula One, that's not really a week off because everyone in the Formula One circus goes from COTA. They all fly back to the UK. They fly back to Western Europe. Then they have to fly into Mexico. They have to bounce a couple of days later into Interlagos. And then they have to cross the ocean to get to Qatar at Lusail, which is an entirely new country and entirely new track to Formula One. So you're absolutely right. It's hopping continents and time zones. I have sympathy. I think they all know what they signed up for and they're professionals. But that said, it's got to be a grind. And, we were talking earlier today with Tim about the fact that there were some logistical challenges getting some of the freight to Brazil. So that's going to compound and complicate and make the weekend even more complex. But the one point that you didn't mention was not only is it this bizarre, unique triple header, but the second race in this triple header is a sprint qualifying weekend.
Well, that's just it, right? And I mean, that's part of the problem is that the fact that a lot of the teams had cars and equipment and everything delayed leaving Mexico City earlier this week means that it's going to be twice as busy to get everything done because this is not a normal Friday. There's actually like important, I mean, anytime they get track time is important, but we got sprint qualifying. I mean, it is going to be a super, super busy weekend. And I completely forgot, 100% transparency and honesty on my behalf. We talked about it last week and I completely forgot that there was going to be sprint qualifying this weekend. But yeah, it's just, it's sort of shaping up to be a bit of a weird end to the season on that part because, they were talking, I mean, are we still going to have sprint qualifying at Yas in December? I mean, no.
No, this will be it.
Yeah, well, I don't think that a lot of people will be sad. This will be the last one. I mean, everybody seems to have really cooled on it, but yeah, it's really shaping up to be a busy one. But let's talk about some of the news at hand. This is one that went or broke earlier today, but it's kind of been out there for a little bit in varying degrees. degrees, and that is Aston Martin team principal Otmar Szafnauer says that the reports that are linking with him to a shock move over to Alpine is nothing but hooey. There's nothing to it.
That was the big breaking story this morning, and I was very excited that we had something really meaty to talk about, but motorsport.com, autosport.com were both reporting that his move to Alpine was imminent, and it was going to happen prior to the beginning of next season. And then all of a sudden, the Aston Martin PR machine, Otmar himself, came forward. They had a full front press. They denied it. They denied it. They denied it. Alpine came out and denied it as well. And, you know, you and I talked about this a little bit earlier today. I have some suspicions that maybe there's something afoot, but I think your perspective on this one is, why defend and come out so aggressively if not for the fact that this isn't happening? What are your thoughts? Do you think there's fire where there might be some smoke here?
Yeah, you know, I kind of keep going back and forth one way or another that no, there probably something isn't going on. But like you say, like where there's smoke, there's fire. I really don't know where I'm landing on this one. I mean, the fact of the matter is that perhaps Lawrence Stroll drove a dump truck full of money up to Otmar's house and the problem has been solved and he'll get on as usual. But I mean, let's not forget that Alpine and Renault, they have tons of, not that money's the only motivator. I mean, the other thing that that you have to consider is Martin Whitmarsh is back in Formula One. I mean, he was a McLaren for, 25, 30 years or something. Been out of the sport since 2014, and now he's back at Aston Martin. So, I mean, that potentially could cap where Otmar could grow within the Aston Martin organization. Now, having said that, I still think there's a lot more. You know, Aston Martin, this whole project is just getting underway. I mean, they only rebranded not even a year ago. I mean, this was Racing Point and then formerly Force India. I think there's a lot more to go. Whereas Renault, Alpine, I mean, yeah, I think there's a lot more that team can do, but they've really struggled since they took over Lotus in, 2014. And, you know, I really expected them and all the resources that they had as Renault-Nissan and all that, that might behind them has really not materialized in my books.
Yeah, I very much agree. I think the timing of this was interesting, and maybe there's something to this, maybe there's not, but it was only a week ago that Alpine Formula One CEO Laurent Rossi had hinted and suggested very much that he was looking at a pretty significant management shakeup for next season for all the reasons that you just indicated.
Well, they have to do it.
Yeah, for all intents and purposes, this team has been, I don't want to say a failure, but I mean, they didn't score a podium until last year, four or 5 years into their return, their re-energized Formula One project. Let's say it. They've been a failure. They're not competing for podiums. They're not competing for race wins. They're nowhere in the championship. They've been a disappointment. And to compound problems, they're no longer supplying power units to any other team. So oftentimes for a team like Mercedes or Ferrari or Honda, you know what? You can supply engines to multiple teams, and Mercedes generates revenue and income from the fact that they're supplying power units to Aston Martin and to Williams. Well, Renault's in this precarious situation now where they're not even earning revenue from this massive, expensive project under which they've undertaken, which is developing a Formula One power unit. So for me, I think there might be something here, but you hinted at it, that one, you have the Alpine F1 CEO hinting at a major structural change, but also the fact that Aston Martin themselves had a bit of a shock announcement. If you go back to the end of September, early October, when Lawrence Stroll introduced Martin Whitmarsh as a new partner within the Aston Martin family. And his role principally is to look after Aston Martin performance division. So it's understood that principally he's going to be overseeing the road car division in a bigger sense, but it was unclear. And he was very unclear when asked about what his role was going to be with the Formula One team. Is Otmar going to have total anonymity and complete decision-making abilities over this team, or is Martin going to inject himself into the decision-making associated with this team? Because Otmar has had tremendous anonymity in terms of operating this team, both under the Red Force India guys, under the Racing Point guys, and now under the Aston Martin guys. And all of a sudden, Otmar's got a new boss that he has to report into. He's not reporting directly into Lawrence Stroll anymore. And perhaps his vision is, I don't necessarily want to be a team principal for the rest of my career. That job is an absolute grind. You're flying to every Grand Prix. You're flying to the factory. You're flying around the globe to see junior drivers. You're wining and dining sponsors. You're doing the hospitality thing. all of those kind of pieces. Being a team principal is a grind, and maybe his vision was, I would like to step away from that, but now all of a sudden there's a ceiling, there's a cap to what his growth opportunities are within Aston Martin, and maybe Alpine flew in, hey, we've got an opportunity for you, which to your point could then have been countered by Lawrence saying, hey, what is it going to take? Here's a blank check. I want to keep the best people here, and I don't want to disrupt my own Formula One project.
Well, yeah. I mean, we have to remember that that Lawrence Stroll has not become immensely successful in all the different areas of business that he's been active in probably his entire life, right? I mean, I think Lawrence was an entrepreneur when by the time he's about 4 years old. He just has that kind of vibe around him, right? And successful at it too, might I add. But the way that I see it, I think that this is maybe Lawrence, I wouldn't say stepping back, but I think this is Lawrence appointing someone that he thinks is very capable to step in and take maybe take some of the work off of his hands so he can still manage to run his empire in other areas. And I think that people like Lawrence Stroll, of course, they're incredibly involved and incredibly knowledgeable about what's happening in all the companies that they run. But I don't think that he can really immerse himself 24/7 into any one venture at any one time. And I see the appointment of Martin Whitmarsh very much in that sort of spirit.
I've heard a couple of interviews with Lawrence Stroll in the last couple of months, and he's often asked specifically, how did you become so successful? And he's frank enough and humble enough to admit, hey, there was a little bit of luck along the way. But overwhelmingly, his point is, I surround myself with good people. Yep. I surround myself with the best people. And I don't think he's in a position now, given where that this project is, and given the fact that Otmar's been there since 2009, he's very much the backbone of that operation. I don't think he's going to let somebody like Otmar walk away unless that's something he wants to see happen. So I think you nailed it. I think there was an offer. I think they were close. And I suspect Lawrence probably just came in and kiboshed it with a big check.
Yeah, probably. And that's you raised such a good point. And the first thing that I thought of is, even though that Zach Brown is not quite the same kind of like businessman, or I mean, he's very successful in his own right, of course. But I mean, as CEO of the McLaren Group, I mean, what has he done? And without Zach Brown, that team is not where they are today. They're not competing for podiums. They're not competing for third in the constructors. They're not winning races like they did at Monza this year. I mean, Zach did very much what he needed to do. He let some people go, and slowly but surely he appointed key people to key positions. And look at the team now. They got a couple of really good drivers. They've got Mercedes power, and look where they've gone. They've gone from the doldrums, and they've gotten right back to on the cusp of greatness again. I mean, they still got a little ways to go, but they, I think, have to be a role model for all the teams that are saying, well, we're not Ferrari, we're not Red Bull, we're definitely not Mercedes, but I think that that Zach Brown and McLaren say, hey, look, we were on death's door, but we got this thing turned around, and if we can do it, so can any of you. Although, you know, it took a lot of financial ninja work to get that done, but that's a completely different story. Okay, I want to talk about this one really quickly before we go into the break, but it does bear mentioning. After almost a decade, not quite a decade, Formula One is finally embracing the fact that they have V6 turbo hybrid power, and they're boasting about it. I mean, this is something that they should have really done a lot sooner. Although I think that maybe the world, or just in general, people weren't ready for it. I think, you know, the technology is absolutely marvelous. But I think in this day and age, what with more people, I think, focused on the issues of global climate change and environmental issues, I think that this message resonates a little bit more. And I think Formula One, they get a fair amount of scrutiny, and rightly so, as being a somewhat, how do you want to call it? An opulent or extravagant racing series, burning a lot of fuel, leaving a massive carbon footprint and things like that. And, you know, which is true to a certain and large degree, but I think that they need to flex on this because, you know, these are, you know, incredibly efficient, wonderful pieces of technology. And I'm sort of surprised that they haven't boasted about this sooner or promoted it, but at the same time, I am. I am and I am not. I think that the timing just wasn't right before now.
before I go on my very long rant, I will concede I recognized what you were suggesting a few minutes ago, which is Hamilton. Let's quickly touch on this topic because otherwise you're going to ramble for 20 minutes. But I totally agree.
Oh, I know you and love this subject a lot.
Oh, I do. And I loved your term as well, to flex. Like, I think Formula One really needs to bring more shine and exposure to maybe the core asset of the racing division, which is this absolutely phenomenally complex and energy efficient power unit. Like, we're talking about a 1.6 liter V6 turbo double hybrid system with thermal efficiency that is better than possibly anything else on the planet. These tight compact packages are simply a phenomenon of engineering, and I think they're really important for a couple of reasons. Because one, Formula One is generating a tremendous amount of energy and power out of a tiny, tiny internal combustion engine. Again, a 1.6 liter V6. They're using forced induction through an incredibly efficient and powerful turbocharger. And they have not one, but two hybrid systems. They have a hybrid system capturing energy from the exhaust gases, and they have a separate hybrid system capturing energy from braking at the rear, all of which is pumped into a battery, which is then tapped into to generate even more power when they're driving. So these cars are a phenomenon.
It's crazy.
I just think it's incredible. Exciting that Formula One now recognizes that, holy crap, we've had this in our cars the whole time. This is probably something that we should be talking about and showing off. So it sounds like Liberty's vision at this point is they want to put this turbo hybrid front and center when it comes to marketing the brand and advertising the brand, that, hey, we have something cool. And it's not just cool from a technical perspective, but it's really cool in the sense that, hey, we are very cognizant of the global environmental crisis, that we are in a period of dramatic climate change, but that we're doing something. We're not sitting back on our laurels and rocking a naturally aspirated V8 with a 4 liters of displacement, that we're doing something. And furthermore, that they want to evolve this concept and this formula into something that will eventually be very similar, minus the MGU-H when we go into 2026, but that they ultimately want it to be consuming e-fuels and synthetic fuels and fuels that are developed based on carbon that's pulled out of the atmosphere. Like, I think this is very cool, and it's something they should be very proud of. And we talk a lot about road relevancy in Formula One and the fact that what we see in Formula One cars should have some sort of linkage to road cars. Maybe not today, but maybe in 5 years when there's some trickle-down technology. But I also think that as much as the world's moving towards electric vehicles, pure EVs, I think there's very much a real segment of road car users like me, that would be more compelled to purchase a plug-in hybrid. So a car that has a dedicated EV motor, but also has a small, compact, efficient internal combustion engine. So you have that flexibility of having a gas tank and not having to worry about range. I think there's a future where all of those things come together. And Ross Braun's talked about this a lot. He doesn't necessarily see a world where everything is powered by an electric engine, and that there's always going to be some room for internal combustion engines, but that those combustion engines will be fueled by synthetic fuels and e-fuels. So that's my rant. I kept it as compact as I could to keep the sponsors happy.
Well done. So, and on that note, let's take a quick break and we'll come back on the other side, and still plenty of things to talk about. And first up will be Alpha finally saying that they're going to confirm their driver lineup next week. So don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510, is he declaring an emergency? There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right, well, welcome back to the show. And yes, Alfa Romeo boss Frédéric Vasseur has finally confirmed who will drive alongside Valtteri Bottas, which, you know, I still can't get my head around completely that Valtteri is going to be there next year. But anyways, they will be announcing that second driver next week. Sounds very much like Antonio Giovinazzi is on his way out of Alpha for next year. Sounds like it's either going to be, was it Guan Yu Zhu or Oscar Piastri, the F2 drivers. Sounds like it's going to be one of the two of them. And I think this is going to be exciting. I think it's going to be a great driver lineup. You get like an experienced, proven quantity in Valtteri Bottas that has been there, won races, helped win championships, and everything. And still at a pretty decent age to be racing competitively in Formula One. As much as I love Kimi Raikkonen, I mean, he's well past his best before date. And I think that, you know, a fresh driver lineup is one of the things that will really help this team next year. Would have been very interesting to see what would have happened had that that deal with Andretti Autosport gone through. But, you know, that's not a thing now. It didn't happen. But it'll be interesting to see what happens. One of the big things is if the Zhu comes along, he's going to bring in, like, was it $25, $30 million of sponsorship money, which will totally help this team. So it just, it'll be exciting to see what the final announcement is. So what's your thoughts on that?
I completely agree. And I love to see Alfa Romeo, Sauber, Frédéric Vasseur. I love to see them starting to assert some independence. And I think that there was very much this sense or this perception over the course of the last 3 or 4 years that they were very much running as not necessarily even Ferrari's B team, but functioning maybe as their C team. And it was clear that I believe that at one point the Kimi deal, signing Kimi after his departure from Ferrari, was very much that, hey, we've got this former world champion. He's going to be really easy to sell sponsors. I think in hindsight, it was probably more doing a solid for Ferrari because they wanted to preserve that linkage to Kimi, who had helped him win a world championship going back to 2007.
Sure.
I think this is very much them starting to assert their independence that, hey, look, we want to be fully in control of who's going to be driving our cars. We want to be fully in control of our destiny as a team. And I think that this driver decision is very much a byproduct of that. And I think it is going to be Zhu. I'm excited. I think it's fantastic for the sport. I think it's great for Sauber. Putting aside the financial benefits of signing him, because to your point, it's going to bring with it $25 or $30 million worth of funding annually from China. But I think it's very cool that we're going to have our first Chinese driver in Formula One. And I think that helps to enrich and build on the fan base in that country. And of course, we didn't go to China last year. We didn't go this year. We're probably not going to go next year, but we should be back for 2023, which is fantastic because I think that's a really important market for Formula One. But I like to see them asserting this independence. And you're right. I don't think this deal happens if the Andretti Motorsport piece goes through because I think they had their eyes very much on somebody else. And I think the only reason that this announcement hadn't happened until now is because the Andretti Motorsport group or Autosport group was absolutely crystal clear that, hey, if we're in the process of buying Sauber or at least buying 80% of it and a controlling interest, we want to be able to decide who's going to be driving this car. And if they're buying Sauber, if they're buying into Formula One, it's because obviously they want to have some degree of American flavor, and they probably would have wanted to have a US-based driver, a US-born driver on that team. But I love the assertiveness. I think this is fantastic. I hope it's Zhu, and I can't wait because I agree with you. Kimi being on the grid today serves no purpose, serves no value to the team. He's not competitive. He's certainly on the unproductive side of 40, and I would love to see more young drivers in this sport.
Yeah, totally. You know, I was just kind of thinking, too, when you were just talking about them, the assertiveness of kind of going their own way rather than letting Ferrari dictate or really heavily influence what decision they make. And we saw that earlier this year with Williams going off script,
absolutely,
if you want to call it that, and going with Alex Albon rather than the expected choice of putting in Nick DeVries, who's a Mercedes driver. Obviously, they have Mercedes power units, and that just kind of seemed like a bit of a done deal. And I couldn't help but think to myself and asking myself if this trend continues, what very much seemed at one point in the past year or so that a lot of these smaller teams might just become de facto B teams or almost junior teams for the big, you know, the Mercedes, the Ferraris and Red Bulls of the world. I think that that's just is not going to happen now, with the exception of AlphaTauri and Red Bull, where that is a legit B team and a development team for the main RBR, right? But these others, yeah, go ahead. Sorry, jump in.
Just hit on something that I'd never thought about until this moment, and you suddenly awoken a thought within me. But it's that in this new world where there's cost certainty and there's a cost cap, mm-hmm, all of these teams are all of a sudden in this position where, hey, previously we were dependent on the funding and the cash that these bigger teams were funneling to us.
Yes.
All of a sudden, wait a minute, if we're now playing on an equal playing field and we all have to adhere to this $135 million cap, I don't need to rely on funding for Ferrari. I can scrape together $135 million a year. So maybe part of this assertiveness, and I love what you said about Williams too, kind of flipping the script on that driver decision. Maybe these teams have got this newfound sense of confidence because, you know what, you may supply us with engines, which is fine. That's a contract. But in terms of all of this other stuff, you dictating who's going to be in our cars and you influencing some of our more strategic decisions, like maybe that's all kind of out the window now, because all of a sudden there's this parity on the playing field, which is, I guess, what the cost cap was designed to do all along.
Well, yeah, I mean, totally. I mean, maybe this is one of these unintended, unexpected consequences or results that we're seeing that we just never thought of before. And I mean, you raise a really, really great point that if all these teams can cobble together enough money to do it, and say you get like a driver like Guanyu Zhou who comes in with $25 or $30 million of sponsorship, you know, that's a good chunk of coin, before you even get going. So it really is a completely different landscape. And ultimately, who knows how it'll play out. I mean, the big teams will always, I think, will always attract the top talent, both on and off the track.
For sure.
You know, I mean, that's just the way of the world, right? I mean, the big successful teams in any sport are always the ones that people always, you know, everybody loves a winner, right? But, you know, having said that if you don't get to go to work for Ferrari or Mercedes, I'm sure you would still be thrilled, you know, if you're one of those people that are qualified to work in Formula One. Sure, that might not be your first pick, but you'd still have a hell of an interesting and rewarding career working for someone else. So not that I'm trying to put a negative spin on that. But sort of sticking with these young drivers and a bit of a related note, George Russell apparently is going to start his Mercedes career right after the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix in December, and he'll join the Silver Arrows in the postseason tire test. So George obviously very eager to get down to work with his not really his new boss, but I mean, considering he already is a Mercedes driver. But this is an interesting one. I mean, could we ever consider George an out and out 100% Williams driver? Was he just kind of like loaned to them over the past, was it 3 years now?
Yeah, that's the way I always saw it, is very much, and I know it's a foreign concept to a lot of our American-based and even our Canadian-based listeners, this concept of loaning out talent. We see it in club football in Europe all the time, yeah. But that was always the way I saw it, was that, hey, he's a Mercedes driver. He's from the Mercedes Academy. He was always destined to drive for that team, but he was basically on loan to Williams. And this goes right back to what I was saying a couple of minutes ago, which is Williams was so financially dependent on the big boys at Mercedes in terms of supplying power units and supplying technical expertise that they weren't really in a position where they had the autonomy to make a driver decision. So ultimately, you know, Mercedes was able to get one of their drivers, one of their academy drivers, into the Williams car, and ultimately probably was the right thing for them because he was a supremely talented driver, but ultimately they didn't have a choice. Now, this offseason, where Mercedes were very much trying to flex on them and put Nyck de Vries into the car, they stepped back and flipped the script, as you so eloquently said a couple minutes ago, and opted for Alex Albon from the Red Bull Academy. But yeah, for me, he was always a Mercedes driver that was effectively on loan. And I always thought that was crystal clear, because even if Mercedes was clear that he wasn't going to have a seat with them, I don't think he was ever going to stay with Williams, not unless they dramatically improve their form over the course of his three-year tenure. But this is exciting, and I'm not surprised that Mercedes want to get him as soon as possible. But I also think that just as much as Mercedes wants to get him into their garage, into their car, and around their teams, I think Williams wants to move on from him because they need to get Alex Albon into their garage and into their team. Because, you know, we talk about George Russell having been on loan to Williams. Well, you know what? He's been around Mercedes. He's done test driving. He's been in the simulator. He's driven the Mercedes car in a Grand Prix. He's familiar with the power unit. He's familiar with the gearboxes because he's been rocking those in his Williams cars. I think Williams is desperate to get Alex Albon into their garage right now because he has no experience with the Williams car. He has no experience with the gearbox. He has no experience with the Mercedes power unit. They need to get him in now. So I think Williams, hey, you know what? George Russell, he's yours. Go. I think where it's going to get a little bit stickier is how quickly is Red Bull going to be willing to give up Alex Albon, who's under contract through the end of December of this year, because Williams needs him around that team immediately, as soon as possible. They would take him today if they could, because they need to start indoctrinating him into the Williams program.
Yeah, you know, I don't see Williams being awkward about letting George free of his obligations at the, you know, I see that working, you know, well for them, but I just don't see the favor being returned by Red Bull. I mean, if they I'm not expecting it. Perhaps it'll work out that that Alex will get there sooner than you know, than maybe a lot of us expect, and as soon as Williams would like, because like you say, I mean, he's going to be the guy. He's going to be the number one driver in that team. And no disrespect to Nicky, but you know, Alex has proven what he can do in Formula One. And, you know, I think that can we go as far as saying that Williams is taking a risk on Alex Albon? Sort of, kind of, but not really. I mean, he comes with an impressive background. I know that his tenure at Red Bull was a little bit shaky, and I think that perhaps maybe they dumped him a little bit too soon. I mean, Checo is, ultimately, he's started to turn it around. I mean, his last several races, you know, the last third of the season was better than the first half of the season, I guess, since the summer break, at least. But, you know, I mean, Alex, you know, on the flip side, I mean, he does have something to prove. I mean, you know, he went into Red Bull showing that that there was something there, you know, when he sort of came in and you know, sort of halfway through the year replacing Gasly. And then when he gets the full season, you know, with that that opportunity to do the most that he can, it didn't work out quite in his favor. So here he is again on the sidelines, coaching Yuki Tsunoda and, you know, doing all the simulator work for Red Bull. You just got to think that this guy's aching and dying to get back into a real car, get out there, put some real miles on the track and start doing that. So I'm sure the feeling is mutual. As much as Williams is eager to get him into the factory, get him into the car at Grove, I think that Alex is probably going to, he's going to be reciprocating that that desire. It's just, you know, what is Mr. Red Bull going to do and prolong that or not? All right, well, let's park it there temporarily. We're going to take a quick break, just checking out the live stream. A couple of things. Craig Day is just mentioning, he said, Rhea Piastri, could the paddock handle two Australians? I don't know, but it'd be fun to watch. Steve Williams countered to say, can't be too many Australians. Double podium shoeys, winky face. Steve also asking, can you guys just tell me who's going to win this championship? The tension is killing me. And we will answer that question right after this very short break from our sponsors, so don't go away. All All right. Well, welcome back to the show. And well, I'm afraid that was a bit of a psych. We will not tell you who's going to win this championship because we ourselves don't know it. Know it quite yet. We have probably some ideas, but just like the rest of you, we're prepared to sit here and wait it out and watch it over the course of the next four races. And it's really shaping up to be an epic finish to what's been an absolutely epic season so far. Before we dive into our preview of the race, and we're going to open up the mailbag, I wanted just to toss this to you. And before we do that, I'm going to hit the MotoGP jingle here, because this has been a while since we've done that. And I know this is something that's near and dear to your heart. You're Mr. MotoGP. And well, let's just say that Valentino Rossi is hanging up the helmet and driving gloves. And I know that you've got some thoughts and some things to say about that.
Heartbreak, tears, pain. Those were all the things I felt while creating that jingle that I spent 2 weeks making licensed music for and never used because we never do MotoGP Corner. But that is entirely my fault. But today, and I didn't know we were doing this segment, so this is purely off the cuff. Perhaps the greatest, I would say, championship formula level motorcycle racer of all time is hanging up his boots. He's hanging up his glove. He's going to put his beautiful fluorescent yellow helmet on the peg. He is done. And he does so after possibly the most sterling career of any motorcycle racer of all time. So let me put some of this into perspective. Across MotoGP and MotoGP2, which is sort of the feeder series that leads into Formula One, he has 9 world championships. He has 65 poles. He has 96 fastest laps. He has 235 podiums. He has 115 wins in 431 races. That means he has won 1/4 of every race he has started. He has scored a podium in more than 50% of every race that he has competed in. He entered MotoGP way back in 2002, right around the time that Kimi and of course Fernando joined the sport. He scored a championship in his first season as a rookie in 2002 with Honda, who he repeated in 2003. And then in a massive shock move, he switched to Yamaha in 2004. He scored a championship with Yamaha that year, 2004. He repeated in 2005. He finished second in 2006, third in 2007. And then in 2008 and 2009, he won the championship before slipping to third in 2010. He had a short-term 2-year ill-fated move to Ducati. He went back to Yamaha, where he finished second in 2014, 15, and 16 against arch rivals Marc Marquez in 14 and 16 and Jorge Lorenzo, his teammate in 2015. And what I would argue was probably one of the most bitter championship duels of all time. Even more so, I would say, than Nico and Lewis in 2016. He leaves as the winningest driver of all time with those 7 chips at the premier level. He brought, I would say, a transcendent and important level of exposure to the sport. I'm all about, you know what, identifying an athlete as somebody that transcends the sport and brings an appeal and awareness that wouldn't otherwise be there. He was absolutely the most transcendent star the sport has ever seen. He made MotoGP, motorcycle racing, must-watch motorsports for the better part of a decade and a half. He has a fantastic personality, energy, charisma. He's fantastic. Possibly the greatest export of Italian motorsports ever. And the reason that he's so relevant in this conversation, and probably a lot of our listeners, especially those in the live stream right now, are wondering is, why is he going on and on about a MotoGP racer? Well, one, we want to give credit where credit's due. But sure, the other really important thing is that between 2004 and 2010, he did 7 tests with Ferrari in Formula One. In fact, towards the end of that run, he was lapping less than a second a lap slower than Michael Schumacher. It's been widely speculated. In fact, Valentino Rossi himself said there was an offer from Ferrari to move to Formula One, and the only reason he didn't accept it was because he wanted to jump directly into a full-time seat with Ferrari, and Ferrari wanted to start him at one of their customer teams before graduating him to the Ferrari team. He ultimately stayed in MotoGP. It was a good move because he continued to win championships. But this was a guy who was so skilled, so talented, that he had the ability to compete at both the highest levels of motorsport, in motorcycle racing and in open wheel racing. He passed on the opportunity because he didn't think it was the right fit, but he could absolutely have competed in Formula One given the performances that he had on the track in those Scuderia Ferrari tests.
You know, it's amazing when you look at those stats and all the things that he did, and the fact that he tested with Ferrari and he did so well over those all those years and all those tests, and he got so close to Schumacher's times. It just can't help but begs that question: What if Ferrari did tried to do the dirty on him, but had they actually given him an offer to drive for the Scuderia rather than one of their customer teams at that time, what could that guy have done in Formula One? I mean, of course, we'll never know, but until, you know, we can solve quantum physics and we can go check out some bizarre parallel universe where that actually happened. It's just an amazing story. And yeah, sad to see him retire, but again, all good stories, all good things come to an end. And this podcast is not one of them, not just yet. Anyway, so before we dive into the mailbag, let's talk about the race itself. So we're going to Interlagos at Brazil, Autodromo Jorge Carlos Pace, or Pache, I'm not sure how to say that, pardon me. Looking good for Sunday afternoon, about 2 p.m. We're looking about 23 degrees Celsius, about 74 degrees Fahrenheit. Looks like it's going to be a mix of sun and cloud in Sao Paulo, Brazil. 19 points separating Lewis Hamilton and Max Verstappen. Lewis challenging, obviously. He's got a bit of work to do to catch up with Max. But if there's anybody that is capable to do so, that would be Lewis Hamilton. And, you know, I've been thinking about this over the past couple of days. Max, he's got a bit of a buffer. He's got a bit of a bit of room. He doesn't quite have all the insurance that he wants. And I think that Max is going, and I don't think Max is going to ease off. I think that he's going to push as much as he needs to over the last four races to really seal this championship. I mean, it can still go either way. Let's be completely honest about this. Just because Max is leading right now, I mean, there's still plenty of points up for grabs over the next four races. And I'm saying four. I'm still not 100% convinced that Saudi is going to happen. I mean, there sounds like there's going to be a lot of work to do before we get to Jeddah in a couple of weeks' time. I have no doubt that the pit facilities and the track will be ready. I'm hoping, but we'll see. And if that doesn't go off, do they cancel it? Do they maybe go to Bahrain, which is also in the region? There's a lot of things obviously in play there. But on the basis, on the fact that we might, or we're going with a four-race finale to the season, plenty of points up for grabs. I think that Max is going to come out flying this weekend because, you know, this is a circuit that's at altitude, as we saw in Mexico last week. This favors the Honda. This favors the Red Bull. And then we go to the three final races of the year in the Middle East at street level, or sorry, at sea level, street tracks, some of them all favoring Mercedes, all power tracks. And, you know, lots of things going on. But I think that Max is going to try and seal the deal here this weekend. And, well, maybe he doesn't seal the deal, but maybe he puts it to a point that it's just becoming too far of a gap with too few races for Lewis to try and catch up after this weekend. What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, I think that's a really great summary of what we can expect going into this race weekend. But like Steve says in the chat associated with our live stream right now, I'm excited for this final run of races, but I think Mercedes is going to be fighting an uphill battle at this track, not least of which is because there's 41 meters of elevation change throughout this very, very short and very, I would say, challenging, exciting track. But mm-hmm. I think the elevation, and I think the momentum that Red Bull's carrying right now suggests that this could be a very good weekend for them. And I think for Mercedes, it's not about, hey, let's try and score a race victory or take a double podium. It's more about damage mitigation, because we go into the final three races where Mercedes, in theory, on paper, technically should perform much better than they do at these two races. Obviously, I think there was expectations going into COTA, which maybe weren't met from a Mercedes perspective, having come out of a run of races where they did look very good and Red Bull looked a little bit shaky. But Red Bull obviously looked fantastic at COTA. Red Bull looked phenomenal at Mexico City. And ultimately, if it was a couple of laps longer, the race, perhaps they score a 1-2 on that podium and all of a sudden Lewis is that much farther behind in the championship. I think this is going to be a tough weekend for Mercedes. But maybe the one thing that does play into their favor, because the altitude won't, the layout of the track won't. I think one of the things that could play into their favor is that it's going to be a compressed, complex, complicated weekend. We're going into Friday. The teams are scrambling to get the cars on the track. We have free practice one tomorrow. Nobody's seen this track in 2 years because we didn't come last year.
That's right.
We have qualifying tomorrow afternoon. So just in terms of having a regime and just in terms of having that muscle memory, it's a very unusual Friday, because all of a sudden Friday's a high pressure situation because you desperately need to qualify well for Saturday. And Saturday we have free practice 3 a.m. and we have sprint qualifying. And all of a sudden you're in a session, which is, do I drive with a tremendous amount of aggression because I need to score a ton of points and qualify well for the Grand Prix on Sunday? Or do I take a more relaxed approach and try to not damage the car or compromise the integrity of the power unit? So I think it's going to be a challenging weekend for everyone. Maybe there's an opening for Mercedes because maybe Red Bull has a little bit of bad luck. And of course, I wouldn't wish that on them, but maybe they have a little bit of bad luck because they have seen tremendous amounts of reliability this year. Maybe not good luck when you consider what happened at Silverstone and what happened at Monza, but they've had really good luck in terms of reliability. The other question going into this race weekend is, as we kind of tee this up, everything this year has been about Max versus Lewis and Mercedes versus Red Bull, but the sense is Lewis probably needs to swap out that power unit again. Mm-hmm. And if he's going to do it this year, you probably need to do it at this race, because I believe, and I don't know if it's going to play out this way, but I have to believe that Mercedes is going to look a lot better when we get to LaSalle and when we get to Jeddah and when we get back to Yas Marina. One, those tracks are at sea level. Two, at least two of them are very much high power, high speed tracks with some major straights, which in theory should play well to the Mercedes strengths. So I think this weekend's all about damage mitigation. And if you can score, if Lewis can score a second on the podium, that's fantastic. If he can be third, well, that's good as long as Valtteri's in the top five, because it's no longer simply about chasing that World Drivers' Championship. It's because Bottas performed so poorly in Mexico City, you need to score as many constructors' points as possible, because now all of a sudden, the constructors' title is on the line. So I like this track. We've seen some phenomenal races there. 2008 was fantastic, of course. 2012 was great. 2019 was a banger when, of course, Max won his first win in Brazil. I'm looking forward to this race weekend, but I think it could be a little bit unpredictable.
Yeah, it's interesting too. I mean, if you go back to the start of the turbo hybrid era in 2014, Nico wins too. Lewis wins in 2016, Seb 17, Lewis again in 18. That should have been the race that Max should have won, but you know, he got tangled up with Esteban Ocon. And there was that argy-bargy and pushing and shoving in the pits afterwards. And then he comes back and wins it in 2019. So, I mean, in more recent times, I mean, it's been a little bit back and forth. I mean, in 2014, 15, and 16, nobody was coming within a country mile of Mercedes. 17 and 18, Ferrari was a little bit more, you know, I wouldn't say on par with Mercedes, but they were definitely challenging here and there. But Max he's driven well here. When was he had that phenomenal outing in the rain? Was it 16? Was it 17? When it rained so hard and they stopped the race for a time? Was that 2016? I mean, he was passing people all over the place in places that he shouldn't have done. Yeah, I think it was 16, because I remember making a ridiculous overtake on Nico Rosberg on a part of the track that he had no business doing so in all that torrential downpour. So I think that this does favor Max. I mean, the one thing that's it, like I say, it's setting up to be a dry race. I mean, certainly we've seen it this this circuit before, that we've had plenty of rain, but certainly not this weekend. Anyways, some quick stats on the track itself. It's 4.31 kilometers or 2.68 miles. Total race length is 305.88 kilometers or 190.06 miles. 71 laps. The podium in in 2019 was Verstappen, Pierre Gasly, and Carlos Sainz. So that was Verstappen in the Red Bull. Gasly in the then Toro Rosso, and Carlos Sainz was driving for McLaren. So just looking at the tires that Pirelli are bringing, it's the mid-range compounds again, C2 hard, C3 mediums, and C4 softs. Oh, and just some of the stats here again. Fastest lap in 2019 was by Valtteri Bottas. His fastest lap in 19 was a 110.698. And VB77 also holds the outright lap track record as a 110.540, which he set in the Mercedes W09 back in 2018. And very much, I think that this has got to be one that favors Red Bull this weekend. And ultimately, whether Lewis needs to change out that ice, we'll wait and see. You know, it's something that he, at least last weekend, he was saying that he could maybe put off and maybe might not have to do. But again, like you say, if he's going to have to take this hit, take the penalty, and if anybody can recover from a five-pace grid penalty, it's going to be Lewis Hamilton. You know, I mean, he's still Lewis Hamilton. He still has a Mercedes, and that five grid place deficit could be overcome over the course of 71 laps. And again, you know, one of the things that could be disastrous for Lewis is finishing out of the points or a DNF, or, you know, on the flip side, you know, that would obviously have massive implications, not for just for his championship bid, but also for the constructors. Because, I mean, that gap that they'd opened up over Red Bull has narrowed right back down. What is the gap between them now? 3-5 points or something like that. It's almost nothing. I mean, with the amount of points that these drivers are scoring between both of those teams, that could easily swing one way or another, depending what happens. But yeah, I mean, certainly if Lewis had a disastrous weekend, a DNF, or finishing out of the points could really seal the deal for Max Verstappen. And Max, he's got a bit of a cushion. I mean, if he has a bad afternoon, you know, this weekend or next, it's not necessarily the, you know, his season over and done. I mean, he's, you know, it would certainly make things a little bit more difficult, but I think there's a lot more pressure on Lewis at the moment. But this is a guy, 7-time world champion. He's been in this position before. He's come from behind to win races, come from behind to win championships. Hasn't always worked out, but he's been in the position before. And if anybody, you know, if there's one driver you didn't want to have chasing you down for a championship, if you're Max Verstappen, you wouldn't want that guy to be Lewis Hamilton, but it is. And for the rest of us, that means it should be one exciting and epic finish to the 2021 World Championship.
The margin for error this weekend, I think, obviously Mercedes has none. If they want to win the constructors' title, they have to have two really rich points finishes from both of their drivers. And if Lewis wants to win, he needs to finish first or second this race weekend. I don't even think third is going to cut it. They need to finish top two this weekend, or Lewis needs to finish top two, and they need to have a lot of luck along the rest of the way. And that said, even if Max does DNF, I don't think that's game over for him. DNFs, let's say Lewis wins. Well, all of a sudden the championship swings, but now all of a sudden Lewis is only 6 points up, which is a razor thin margin with three races left. So, you know, Max is in a position where the pressure's off a little bit. They could afford to have one bad Grand Prix between here and the finale at Yas Marina. Lewis, Mercedes, they can't afford, you know, Valtteri really put, I get so frustrated thinking about this, but Valtteri really put them in a compromising position with that early braking, that bad start in Mexico City. You know, it wasn't so much just the fact that he braked early and he left the door wide open for Max Verstappen. And that overtake by Max Verstappen, that was beautiful. That was daring. That was brave. That was beautifully executed. He deserves all the credit for it. But Valtteri's early braking compromised his race because it put it in traffic. And of course, he was then clipped. He was spun. And he doesn't score any meaningful championship points. He didn't score any championship points. Really, the only thing he did of value from that point onwards was steal the 1 point from Max, which would have been fastest lap. That was the only thing he contributed. So he really put them in a tough position. But I think it's going to be a very, very, very strong weekend for Red Bull. Now, again, anything can happen. It's just going to be a crazy weekend. We don't know what freight's there. We don't know what freight isn't there. We've got qualifying tomorrow. We've got a sprint race on Saturday. And of course, we have the Grand Prix on Sunday. It's going to be a crazy weekend. And there's a lot of points available. If I'm Max Verstappen, if I'm Lewis, I could score 25 points from the win, a point from fastest lap, and 3 points from the sprint. So I could score 29 points this weekend if everything goes well. I don't think Mercedes is going to have the pace of the Red Bulls. They need to do damage mitigation and they need to be darn well teed up for LaSalle, which again is a track that none of them have raced a Formula One car on. So it's going to be a crazy 7 or 8 days.
Totally. Before we go into our last break, and when we jump into the mailbag on the other side, Mark, I just wanted to get your take on this. Now, Max said if he wins the world championship, he will absolutely rock number one on his car next year. Your thoughts on this? Arrogance, or is this rightly reviving a treasured and time-honored Formula One tradition?
So full disclosure, I didn't even know this was a thing until somebody posted it. I didn't even know it was a thing. I saw the story. I'm just like, that's a weird question to ask a driver. And then I saw some memes earlier today. I think one of them was from one of our listeners, Jason. And it was like, I was this many days old when I learned that this was a thing. I literally learned that this was a thing today. So maybe in the spirit of enriching our listeners, you can explain what this is all about.
So for years and years and years until recent times, the team drivers or the drivers numbers would change each and every year. And this is just a more modern take on things, these personal driver's numbers, which, you know, honestly, I really love. I love the concept. So I know each and every year that the Max is 33, Lewis is 44, Seb is 5. And I always found it difficult in the old days, you know, to make myself like a sad old man, that each and every year that the driver's numbers would change, except for Ferrari, who always had 27 and 28, which was a tribute to Gilles Villeneuve, who was killed at Zolder at the Belgian Grand Prix way back in 1982 or 1983. And that was such a traumatic experience. Enzo Ferrari himself insisted that that was something that that they would always carry. And that's what they always did in years that they didn't win the world championship, which before the Schumacher era was always. Anyhow, but the thing was that each and every year, the driver who would win the world championship would have number one on his car the year thereafter. So that would be the one thing you would know, that back in those days, if Nigel Mansell won the world championship, he wouldn't have number five, he would be number one. If Senna won, he'd have number one. So you just knew that. And then everything else would take you about 15 races to get used to before the season was over. And so I saw this, quote from Max earlier this week, and I can understand that maybe some people didn't fully appreciate it, but I think this is a part of Formula One heritage, and I think that's something that should be revived. I think it should be brought back, that if a driver does win the world championship, let them have the number one on their car, and because it's the recognition of a very, very difficult accomplishment. And I mean, they can still have all the rights to their own personal number for the next season, that, you know, if it's just a one-off shot, that, you know, you go back to 33 or 44 or whatever it was. And, you know, it's very much as Michelle G says in the live chat, she says, winner earns number one, you can't hate about that. And I totally agree. I'd love to see it come back. And if Max is the guy that wins it and he decides to do it, then, you know, I think that would be awesome. But, you know, it would be interesting, you know, if, and I hadn't seen any quotes from Lewis, but, you know, it would be kind of cool to see it brought back, regardless who wins the championship, either this year or next year. I think some of the things that in any sport, you know, embrace the things that work and, you know, the stuff that that doesn't, just let that fall by the wayside. But I think this would be a cool one to bring back. Okay, so let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to open up the mailbag. Sounds like it's bursting at the seams, so we'll do that in just a moment. So don't go away. We will be right back. All right, well, welcome back to the show. It's mailbag time, and just follow up on the previous segment. Steve Williams asking in the live chat, basically saying, well, if Lewis or Max gets number one, if they're world champion next year, does that mean that Mazepin gets number 20? I don't think you can go lower. Obviously, ouch. All right, mailbag time. Why don't you take it away, sir? I know you've got them all prepped and ready to go.
I've got a few. And for those of you listening at home or even on the live stream, tonight's pod's going to be a little bit shorter because we're actually going to drop two pods on Friday, November the 12th. So you've got two to look forward to. So if this one seems a little bit short, just look at your stream. You'll see another one there, a very special edition in which we were joined, or we joined Tim Haraney. But got some great questions in the mailbag. And these are more general and maybe less specific about the current championship, but I think they're fair questions. Now, the first question, and I'll let you take this one first, is from Danica, and her question is, what is it that you two do for work that's so important that you can't do the podcast full time? So I'll let you take that one away.
Money. at this point in time, the podcast doesn't pay enough to that we can walk in and hand in our notices to our respective bosses and do this full time. Which not wanting to enrage my current employer or give him reason to let me go. Less said about that. The better. I mean, if we could do this 5 days a week, man, that would be living the dream, 100%.
I completely agree. And we've admittedly dreamed about, hey, what could this look like if we could do this even part-time, not even full-time, if we could carve out 20 hours a week to do this show. We've talked about we would build a studio, we would have proper visualization, we would work to get credentials and travel. It's really, really tough when you have a career that you require because you need to be able to pay the bills and the mortgage and even just having the kids. And I think we both do a good job, especially you, of being able to carve out some time late in the evenings each week. But we would love to do it. It just comes down to that delicate balancing act of family time and not compromising our careers because that pays the bills. And again, we would love to do it. If somebody came along and made that possible, we'd certainly have the conversation. But I think for now, we do this for fun and we do it because we get such great feedback from our listeners,
totally,
whether it's in spaces or DMs. That's why we do it. And if the feedback wasn't great and the community wasn't great, we'd probably just tap out. But we have so much fun interacting with people and trying to make this community inclusive that it keeps us coming back. And every now and then, we'll do a pod and it'll be a grind. And we just think like, hey, we're doing this because people genuinely, thousands of people download the podcast every episode and we know they enjoy it and we see the reviews. That keeps us coming back every time. Now,
totally, 100%.
Next question for you. So this one comes from Carmen. She says, my boyfriend is a big fan of the show, but is always too nervous to reach out. He plays the PlayStation version of F1 2021 endlessly. He'd like to know, but is too shy to ask, do you guys play on Xbox or PlayStation? And if so, would you be willing to play with him?
Yeah, totally. I'm on the PlayStation. So give me a follow on Twitter at MarkDailyF1, slide in my DMs and we'll connect if you guys are also on PlayStation. I think that'd be cool.
That's fantastic. I have an Xbox. I don't have a new version of F1. I think the last version I have is probably 2019, but I commit to getting the most up-to-date version next year because I really want to see what Electronic Arts is doing with the franchise. Oh, this is a good question. So this comes from Alec. If money weren't an obstacle and you could buy any F1 team, which would it be and why?
Do you want to go first? Or shall I go first?
I'll take this one. I think we probably have differing answers. Hopefully we do. I think for me, if I was taking over an F1 team, I'd want it to be a project and I'd want an excuse to tear it down and rebuild it. But I would also want to buy a team that has a degree of heritage. So for me, that team would be Williams. Mm-hmm. I think this is a team that still carries a strong amount of swagger and prestige in terms of the constructors' titles it's won, the drivers' titles it's won. I think there's still a really good, great, solid community around that team. I love how embedded it is within the community at Grove. For me, it would be Williams, and I'm quite jealous of Doralton and the fact that they get to embark on this journey, and I'm excited because I think they're going to do some good things. But if I was going to buy a team, it would be Williams, partly because I get a bit of heritage, some history, but there's also an opportunity to transform it and turn it into something great.
Me, I'd go for Ferrari. If there money was no object, there's just something about Ferrari, about those scarlet red cars and the fact that nothing sounds like a Ferrari. I mean, if you see a Ferrari drive by on the street, it makes your heart beat. I mean, if you just think about the names, the drivers that have driven for that that team, the fact that they've been there from day one, the fact that old man Enzo Ferrari built this team up from nothing, and this was a racing team that built road cars to basically finance their race team, and this whole legend, this mystique, this thing that has become Ferrari over the decades and the years, it's just, I don't know. There's no one quite like Ferrari. Let's put it that way. Love him or hate him, there's only one Ferrari.
And I think so many people with a question like this will always try to go with the underdog. So I think that's very brave of you to go all in. No, Ferrari, that would be the team. Money aside, that, yeah.
I love the call on Williams response, though. Like, I mean, there's so many great Williams cars. I mean, there's a really cool video. Go search it up on YouTube. Valtteri Bottas, when he was driving for Williams a couple of years back, got to do a heritage day and got to take out what was an FW14B, you know, the active suspension. It was really, really cool. I think it might have been something, it might be a BBC video, but it was really, really cool. And I mean, you know, like, you know, and just like getting Valtteri's reactions, looking at the car, driving the car, you know, the whole thing was really, really awesome. And just able to see that car again in all those colors, the white, the yellow, the red, and, you know, all the Camel tobacco sponsoring scrubbed off, but still the car with that Renault power in it. You know, I was just saying, nothing sounds like a Ferrari, but you know, that's early 90s, excuse me, Williams, that Williams Renault was something special as well.
Another great question here from Jenny. A few weeks ago, the two of you were talking about the results of the Formula One fan survey, and you spent a lot of time talking about the fact that F1 didn't take a modern lens on how people consume Formula One content in 2021. How do you consume Formula One content today? Where do you get your news? How do you watch the races?
So I watch all the races now exclusively on F1 TV. I do have TSN as part of my cable package. And the one reason that I've gone exclusively to F1 TV is because, you know, for me, you know, the cost isn't an issue. So, you know, I'm fortunate in that regard. But the fact is that there's no interruption during the race. And, you know, I can watch everything, you know, not just the fact that you get all these opportunities, you can check the different cameras, you can check the pit lane, you get all the timing, you get all the telemetry and stuff like that. I just like the fact that I can watch the race feed as intended without any interruptions. Now, for the day-to-day news, I follow on social media. I'll check out different things like YouTube on the official Formula One channel. Different websites are extremely useful as well. And then, you know, just connecting with other people in the media, like our good buddy Tim, who always has some good news, some interesting news to share whenever we chat offline.
Yeah, I think those are some really great answers. I'm the same. As soon as the F1 TV Pro app became available in Canada, I jumped on it, not least of which, of course, was because of the fact that you don't have to contend with commercials, which is absolutely a blight on TSN's broadcast. We don't see it in the US. We don't see it in the UK. We don't see it in so many of the countries where Formula One is broadcast today. But the app for me was a game changer, especially when, well, one, earlier this year, I was able to start airplaying the content directly on my TV. And then excitedly, a couple of weeks ago, Formula One Liberty deployed the Apple TV app, which was a game changer. So now I can watch one stream on my TV, I can watch another stream on my computer, I can watch another stream on my phone. So I'm consuming Formula One broadcasts in a way that I never imagined would be possible even 2 years ago. Now, in terms of getting F1 news, I'll be very honest. As active, I think, as our account has become on Twitter, the only thing that motivates me and keeps me going back today is because I found it's the best way to interface and learn about our community and learn about the people that support us and to have conversations with them and get a sense of what they're thinking and what they like and what they don't like about Formula One and the championship. I feel like Twitter and in fact Spaces especially has been really, really great for all of that. But I've had to be a little bit more careful this year with Reddit and Twitter just in terms of the messaging that's out there. This has been a very divisive championship, and I've had to be very careful to watch my mood when I've been consuming Formula One news and updates and fan reaction through social media. So I love Twitter. I think it's an absolutely brilliant platform. I love Spaces. I love Reddit. But I've had to distance myself a little bit this year just because the championship's been so divisive and at times very, very toxic. And I don't necessarily need that in my life. It's not productive. So I'm very, very careful and very selective of which accounts I follow and who I look to for news and updates and things like that. Whereas in the past, I could just scroll aimlessly through a feed for 20 or 30 minutes and consume nothing but bad information. So I'm a little bit more careful. I do still like Reddit, but I use Reddit principally because I like to get a sense of where the community is on certain topics. So for me, that's really, really important.
Cool.
Cool. Are you ready for another question?
Let's hear it.
Okay. Do you think, and this is a really good question as well, because we consume so much of Formula One, at least the broadcast, through the lens and the scope of Sky News. But do you think a U.S. broadcaster should start doing a U.S.-based broadcast of Formula One using U.S. personalities and former U.S. drivers or motorsports drivers?
Yeah, I mean, why not? I mean, back in the day when we had Speed TV, Speed Channel did a great job with Bob Varsha as the play-by-play as the race commentator, David Hobbs and Steve Matchett. Those guys did a wonderful job, calling the races and discussing everything about it. I mean, it can be done, and the question is the market ready for it? I would think so. You know, ultimately, it just comes down to me, whoever does it, I just want to see them do a good job. You know, like, are the people involved, do they know Formula One? Do they understand the vibe of what's going on? What's interesting in terms of what's happening on the track, what's off the track? Maybe have their finger on the pulse of what's, what's important to the fans. So, I mean, it would be pretty cool. I think that certainly in this day and age, it could be done. The question is anybody ready to step up and do it right now?
I very much agree. And I think for me, there was some flashes of hope during the US Grand Prix when we had Danica Patrick step in, and she was fantastic. I think the challenge is, as great as she was, would she, for instance, want to sign up to do this on a full-time basis? Because great if point. Formula One's a 25 race calendar, and it's very different than NASCAR, where most of those races are a couple of hours apart by car or train or a 30-minute flight. If you're committing and signing up to Formula One, that is a grind. We are talking flying globally, like we described earlier today. You're in COTA, Mexico City, Interlagos in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and then all of a sudden you're in the Middle East. Like, it is absolutely a grind, and I don't know if she in particular would sign up for that. If she does, fantastic. I would love to see it. But I think we probably will see more American personalities injected into the broadcast. I think it's very unusual that even now in 2021, the bulk of the US broadcasts are based off of the Sky feed. And that's not to slag or take a shot or diminish what Sky does, because I think they do a great job. But I think the US audience will ultimately evolve into a place where, as more and more Americans become involved in the sport and you see more American ownership and you see more American drivers, I think the audience will mature, and I think American involvement in the sport will mature to a point where there's a demand for it. But that said, I think the audience now is very familiar with the Sky personalities. I think they're very familiar with so many of the British-based personalities because of Drive to Survive, and those voices and those individuals and those people and their perspectives are comfortable and they're familiar. But I think there'll come a time when ESPN breaks away from Sky a little bit and does a little bit more, maybe in terms of in-studio analysis and things like that. But I think it's coming.
Yeah, cool.
Okay. Those are the best ones for today. I think we'll leave it at that, unless you've got any yourself.
No, just a couple of shout outs here to Jerry Blaney and Clive Corfield, who sent some emails into the just to touch base and say hello. So thanks for checking in, and thanks for all the tweets and all the questions. Thank you to everybody in on the live chat. Michelle G saying, I love listening to the British accents on Skyfeed. And I must admit, I do enjoy listening to David Croft and Martin Brundle. I think they do a wonderful, wonderful job commentating the races. Anyways, right. Well, guys, thank you very much for downloading, listening to the show. Enjoy the race this weekend. If you want to get in touch, by all means, do so. Follow us on Twitter at ScuderiaF1Pod. Send us an email at ScuderiaF1Pod@gmail.com. That is it. That is a wrap. Enjoy the weekend. Enjoy the bonus show that will drop later this afternoon. And we will be back on Sunday night to discuss the British Grand Prix. It's like I've regressed 6 months of the season here. Anyways, we will be back to recap the Brazilian Grand Prix. And until then, have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you guys again soon. Bye for now.